Welcome to another Learning Works program. I'm Tony Ryan. We often speak of literacy and numeracy in the one breath, and it seems to me that numeracy skills, that is, an ability to work with numbers each day and in handling our money or understanding mathematics, can sometimes be overshadowed by literacy, that is, our ability to read and write. To find out more about how we gain numeracy skills, I recently caught up with a visiting English educator, Dave Baker, reader in numeracy and post-16 mathematics from the London Institute of Education in the United Kingdom. Dave Baker, welcome to Australia and to Learning Works.
Thank you very much, Tony. It's good to be here.
Mathematics. A lot of kids find great difficulty in schools, don't they? Why is it so?
The answers are probably fairly complex, but to me, one of the interesting issues is going to be that the mathematics we teach has very little meaning for them, very little purpose, very little obvious outcome. Some children don't mind that, and some children seem to do quite well. But there are children, particularly from certain social backgrounds, who find mathematics much harder than others. And it's because there's a social background issue here that we need to rethink some of the ways we view mathematics.
Clearly, of course, we're thinking at the moment in terms of an Australian context, but you've done some work in African countries, for instance. What are you finding there?
Yes, I've been very lucky. We've actually done some work in Ethiopia and Uganda, Mauritius, Sri Lanka, South Africa. And we are finding that the mathematics that people want to teach are these formal numeracy practices, formal mathematical activities, which are often seen as decontextualized, culture-free, value-free. And so notions that, I don't know, 10 takeaway 2 is always 8 is one of the issues that does strike me as perhaps problematic for a lot of children worldwide and certainly for children in Africa. And maybe it would be interesting to actually look at 10 takeaway 2 and see if we could find a way of thinking about that that reveals what I mean. So if, for example, we thought of 10 birds in a tree and 2 get shot and how many left, now in a maths classroom, the answer's got to be 10 takeaway 2 is 8. But if you were a farmer, for example, you might say 10 birds, 2 get shot. I've still got 10 birds, 8 live, 2 dead. So you get a different answer. The answer there is still 10.
Yes, indeed.
If you're a bird watcher, on the other hand, and 10 birds in a tree, 2 get shot, how many left? The answer is 0 because the other 8 have flown away. If you're a hunter, you might say the answer is 2 because you've got your 2. And if you're a conservationist, you might actually come out and say there are 8 because, after all, you're trying to conserve birds. So you get different answers depending on context and depending on values. And that's what I'm arguing. And it might be that some children come with some background. And if we start from there, we can move them towards the more abstract ideas that they need to get. So one of the examples I remember being shown in South Africa by people there was a story which is quite, it's not a real story, but quite a nice story, which is about a teacher teaching percentages one day. And having taught it, she thought she'd done really well. So to check the next day, she asks the child a follow-up question. And she says the following: if I lend your parents $100 at 10%, how much will they have to pay me at the end of the year? The child says the word nothing. In other words, they have to pay nothing. The teacher thinks the child does not understand and so repeats the question. The child again says the word nothing. The teacher is now upset about the child's response and what it says about her teaching, so pursues the matter. Listen, I taught you percentages yesterday. You must know that if someone borrows $100 at 10%, then $110 needs to be paid back at the end of the year. You know that, surely? The child: of course I know that, but you don't know my parents. So there you have an example of the way money impacts differently. Some children would have parents who would find ways maybe around paying that back. Others would recognize that when you borrow money, you do have to pay back. It's just part of the financial practices that we engage in.
I guess some of the people, let's say in developing countries, let's say Asia or Africa or India, would not be very good at mathematics or calculations or numeracy as we know it, but they know how to do it in their own business, for instance.
So, for example, the case that we were looking at was Brazilian street children. This is quite a famous example of children in Brazilian streets. I think it was Sao Paulo, Rio de Janeiro, where the children were observed buying and selling small goods, biscuits, cans of drink and so on, and managing their change and their immaculately. They were seldom wrong, and if they were ever wrong, they were wrong in their own account, which is not Not surprising. But when they were asked exactly the same problems, but in a written form, they couldn't do these. So when the uses and meanings of the giving of change was made sense to them, they were actually very effective. But when they were asked it in a classroom-based context, they found that much harder. So the context itself is clearly a really important issue. And I think we'll come up with similar ones to do with adults, say, working in India. We've watched rural women working in India and rural women working in Ethiopia, who have similar things. They're very effective in handling their own agricultural practices, taking things to market and so on, but they can't do them on paper.
You're listening to Learning Works, and my guest today is Dave Baker, reader in numeracy and post-16 mathematics from the London Institute of Education in the UK. In Australia, as I'm sure you'll soon find out, we're very good at calculating, particularly if you follow the AFL football. Here's, I guess, an example where someone might have low numeracy skills but know exactly what to do to calculate the football scores.
Indeed. And Tony, I'm sure you'll know that one of the famous examples that people always mention is darts. Footy scores, the numbers are relatively simple, but in darts, where you're throwing doubles and trebles and starting at 501, and there are people you watch in darts tournaments or in pubs where they subtract almost without any effort at all in ways that I, as a mathematician, would struggle with. In similar ways, they're fantastic when they come to looking at odds and betting shops. They can work out what their winnings are without any problem at all. So if we start with those kind of practices that they're used to, I think we can build on those. And what we're doing now, you're finding worldwide research, is people are looking for these activities where things are rich, with lots of outcomes, lots of interesting mathematical potential. And then we're building on that to actually enable people to learn mathematics.
But surely we can't take gambling as an example, can we?
Well, that's an interesting one, because particularly with adults, I'm not thinking about children there, but adults, if they do gamble, we could actually use those skills. On top of that, if we look at gambling, one might well be able to talk them out of gambling, in the sense that the lottery in the UK, for example, has odds of 14 million to one against winning, and yet people still bet on it. At 14 million to one, there is almost no point in betting. So by looking at odds and understanding them, you could well find you reduce the amount of gambling, because people become more sensible in what they're going to spend their money on.
It's easy to fall into the trap, isn't it, of saying, well, someone's got to win it.
Yes, no, that's true. And there are lots of cases. But I think of odds more as about risk. There's been some research done. Actually, it was interesting in Australia about what is the value of wearing a cycle helmet, for example. And the research showed that you would have to cycle. I know that these figures are very strange, but this is what came out. For something like 3,000 years before you were likely to have an accident where your head was hurt. And the answer then is there's no point in wearing a cycle helmet, but it could always be you. And so it's an issue to do with risk. If you have an accident and you hurt your head, that has severe consequences. Even if it's really unlikely, you might well do that. In fact, what was really interesting was they then looked at the way drivers treated you if you wore a helmet or not. And it was research in Australia that pointed out that actually the widest berth that motor cars gave bicycles was when the cyclist was a woman wearing a long skirt, no helmet, and then they avoided them. Whereas a man wearing lycra and a helmet, the motor cars got much closer. So it's much more dangerous, if anything, to wear a helmet if you're a man on a bicycle.
What is all this saying about how we actually teach students, let's say adult students who come into an adult education centre with very low numeracy skills? Where do we start?
Well, I think what we're arguing now, and the evidence seems to be that if we start from where they are, their strengths, their skills, what they can do, and their uses and meanings of numeracy, what if we start from that, and that's not necessarily easy for a teacher, but that's what we think we should start with, we could then teach them the more abstract skills that they need to pass their various examinations and get their qualifications. Instead of thinking ourselves, these students, as lacking, for example, an ability to handle watches or to handle fractions or to handle percentages, we start from where they are: ability to handle money, the ability to use odds, the ability to build doors and angles and frames of pictures. If we start from those practices, the financial, domestic, building practices. I think we've got a lot of evidence now. We can then teach them all sorts of things that are linked to what they can already do, not what they can't do.
But what about those very important things like finding 4/5 of 3/8?
Well, those are things that do have a place for students who are in university, because in university you might well have to work out fractions, but to do with in an algebraic setting. But in a numerical setting, you would never need to work that out. But in an algebraic setting, you might. Now, those skills could well be taught to people when they are actually needed, when it actually is useful for them, when they are beginning their perhaps post-16 or university courses.
You used the word decontextualized earlier. Mm. What did you mean by that?
Well, formal schooled numeracy, which you could call formal maths, formal numeracy, is often seen as value-free, culture-free, and not cited in a context. And I suppose it seems to show up in the sense that when you look at classrooms all over the world, they seem to do very similar things. So I've seen students in a Tanzanian classroom where the teacher was teaching them in Swahili, and I followed the whole lesson because she was teaching them fractions, decimals, and percentages. That's seen as decontextualized. I think I'd argue and say it's not decontextualized. The context is the classroom. You can't say it's not context because the classroom says you need to do certain sorts of mathematics. But that's very different from what you might do at home or the market and so on. So it's claimed to be decontextualized, but in effect it's not. It's actually strongly contextual. It's the classroom context.
Dave, what is the message in all of this for teachers and how they actually go about best preparing to teach young people or adults?
So there are two messages. The first one is if you treat numeracy as social and always see that it's based in context with values and various kind of relationships, then you can build on that to move towards the kind of formal classroom. The problem comes in if you're going to build on learner strengths is how you find out what those learner strengths are. And you could find yourself in a classroom with anything between 10 and 30 students. And how are you going to find out what they know, what they can do, what their interests are, what the meanings and uses? And I think what we're trying out now, and we've tried this in several classrooms, at the moment only really to do with adults, but it's to do with helping teachers become sensitive to learners. So instead of thinking, for example, for a teacher who is teaching bus timetables, but the teacher herself never catches buses, she could actually start with the students and actually talk to them about the way they use buses. So if you catch a bus at the moment, in Melbourne, you'll find that the bus stop will tell you how many minutes before the bus comes. You don't need a bus timetable. Teachers don't necessarily catch buses and might not know this. So what we're talking about is how we can get teachers sensitive to the fact that what they think is important might be not what the learners do. And the way you do that is, if you like, taking a perspective which says always involve the learners, talk to them, observe them, watch the way the things they think are important, because you as a teacher needs to always be sensitive to what they can do and not always putting your emphasis on what they can't do. So, for example, going out and watching youngsters playing games outside would be one of the ways of becoming more aware of the kinds of numeracy math that come into their games, watching them in transport, watching them in shops. And I think there is a place here for training teachers to actually be involved in going out and observing people as part of their teacher training course so that they learn about being sensitive to other people's strengths and ideas.
So capitalizing on their strengths, it seems to me, would have the advantage of building their self-confidence and acknowledging their current skills and abilities.
Indeed, valuing what they can do, and so that you don't criticize them and always see them in deficit. You see what strengths they've got and you build on their strengths. You know, from strengths you get strengths.
Dave Baker, thank you for talking to Learning Works.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tony.
My guest today in Learning Works was Dave Baker, reader in numeracy and post-16 mathematics from the London Institute of Education in the UK. Dave Baker was in Australia in October as a keynote speaker at the annual conference of the Australian Council for Adult Literacy. Well, that's our program for today. The South Australian Government supports the Learning Works project through the ASEND Community Partnerships Unit, Department of Further Education, Employment, Science and Technology. From PBAFM in Adelaide, I'm Tony Ryan.